Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are helping America persuade America. That's the whole thing. Complicated times out there sometimes require sophisticated techniques. So we're going to try to do a little bit of that. I'm Dr. Dan, late night comedy writer, stand-up comic, rhetorician, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. And basically what I'm doing is, especially the first ones that I've done here, is going out and grabbing friends of mine and pulling them over here because I know they're interesting people and they got things to say and they're entertaining. So the podcast, I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics. I convert conservatives sometimes because I'm fascinated by the right and kind of the rise of the right in the last 5 to 10 years. And I talk to persuasion pros. I have more rhetoricians on this podcast than any podcast in the world. That's my claim. More rhetoricians. My guest today, longtime favorite comedian of mine. I've known him for quite a few years. In stand-up, you kind of pass each other every 2 or 3 years. And sometimes, you know, you have these 20 or 25 year relationships and you've seen each other probably a handful of maybe 5 to 10 times. It's an interesting way of doing relationships. He's also a comedy writer, has been a comedy writer, and he jumps off mountains in Chattanooga, manages to survive that over and over again. So I'm going to call him the Icarus of Tennessee. And we're going to talk today to Kid Dave Miller. Kid Dave.
Hey, Dan French. Thanks for having me. What'd you call it? I can't think of the sophistication of something. And we're the opposite today. We're way out in the, we're like 10 miles from the nearest stoplight. There's no building codes in this county. There's
really no building codes.
I think there's electrical code in this county, but other than that, I don't know that there's any codes in it. You see some stuff, people living in some stuff that you're like, what the fuck?
That's funny. What county is it?
Dade County, Georgia.
Dade?
D-A-D-E.
Okay.
It's the very most northwest corner where Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia all come together. It's right in the tip. Alabama's about 5 miles that way. Tennessee about 10 miles that way.
Huh. How about that? Yeah, you look like where I grew up. My grandparents are from New Albany, Indiana. And same thing, lived out in the country, septic tank. You know, it was through their garbage over the side of the hill.
Uh-huh. Actually, an interesting little Dade County factoid with all this stuff that goes on and all the Confederate memorials or statues and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Dade County, Georgia, there is a mountain here called Lookout Mountain. You've probably heard of it. That runs, faces to the northwest. So Dade County is between Lookout Mountain and it's pinned into the corner. And there was no road into this county from the rest of the state until like the 1940s. You had to go around through Chattanooga to get here. Very isolated place. They kind of did whatever they want because what were they going to do? You know, they're not going to come get them. So this county before the Civil War seceded from the state of Georgia before any of that other stuff happened. Dade County seceded, called themselves their own state, the state of Dade. And anyway, Civil War takes place, Reconstruction, all that business. Somebody in the courthouse, like in the 1960s, digs up some document. And it's like, we never rejoined the Union, you know? And apparently, I wasn't here. I'm not from here. But there was like a big parade and party downtown. Dade rejoins the Union, the last holdout, you know, in like 1960s or something.
Oh, that's great. That's like those guys that, you know, surrendered in Japan 40 years after the end of the war.
Yeah. But this area right around here was huge. Civil War battles, you know, because the mountains, the Blue Ridge, the Cumberland Plateau, all that stuff sort of comes together right here. That's why there's only one interstate now that goes through just through the mountains. That's the flattest way to try and get through, whether you're driving wagons and cannons and stuff. They had to come through here to get to Atlanta and the rest of the South. So there's huge Civil War battles were within 20 miles of right here. And then there's a water. Lookout Creek was a water source, and there was all up and down or through here was huge encampments of soldiers from both sides getting ready for this Chickamauga battle over here on the other side of the mountain. That was mass. It was the last, once the Union Army could get through this gap, then there was no stopping them because it flattens out on the other side. But this was the last chance, bottleneck to try to stop them. So that's where
they were. Sherman marched through there on his way to burn down the South?
Yep.
Man, that guy. Can you imagine fighting like that in the mountains? I mean, you know what it's like to just kind of get around a mountain? In a car, yeah, it's hard.
Half those guys were barefoot and, you know, and then when Sherman got to a certain point, I guess, you know, the Union had lots of railroads and they could move their stuff around further north, but down here, not very many. So instead of constantly worrying about resupplying his troops and stuff, it was just like, hey, man, just loot everything and eat as you go, and which was sort of part of the tactic of we're going to make this so bad on those guys down there, they won't ever think about doing this again.
Right. And, that's funny. Like when Napoleon invaded Russia, like he had the biggest army in the world by far, like 600,000 people in his army. And the Russia is so big, they just kind of waited for winter. And then they would hit him and his whole army would come at them and they would retreat and burn everything so they couldn't get any food.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's where scorched earth policy comes from for, you know, that kind of battle style. And they just right. kept hitting, retreating until he got so far away from his supply lines, his army starved.
Uh-huh.
Right there in the middle of the Russian winter. It's like, ah, look at that.
See, those guys are smart, you know, and the art of war and battle goes back, you know, to the beginning of time. Tactics like that, it would be like, just because you advance some technologically, it's like, but we can still do this. This worked for that guy.
Yeah.
He was outnumbered, but he did this. He could hide here. He could move this way. Still goes on now.
Well, we were talking about this a little before we started, like my background in rhetoric. So my academic, I was a professor for 20 years. Of rhetoric, and rhetoric is verbal warfare. I mean, it's just using very, you know, elaborate techniques, this whole set of techniques to do persuasion on people. And they don't know the techniques. So most people never get trained in this. So it kind of gives you that kind of, you know, technology advantage, like the stirrups. Remember, like the Spaniards basically took over all of South America because they had horse stirrups. They could stand up on their horse and swing a sword.
Uh-huh. You know?
Because that one piece of technology, and that's sort of the idea behind rhetoric. It's just all these little technical, you know, technologies of persuasion.
Well, even, you know, in the Civil War, when those guys were coming to the South, and they pretty much had to stop at Atlanta for several months because this is the rainy season here, right? And everything was so muddy that every wagon, anything would be so bogged down in the mud, you couldn't move. So, you know, they attacked until it started raining, and it's like, we gotta wait. And they kind of waited it out in Atlanta, and then when the ground firmed up, there they went to Savannah, and I guess they turned north from there, South Carolina, North Carolina, whatever.
Are you interested in that stuff? Do you follow history at all, or is this just tangential knowledge that's drifted into Kid Dave's brain over the years?
You know, my family is from Georgia and was in Atlanta, Savannah at that time, so I know a little of it that way. I'm not steeped into it. There's some of these, a comedian named Roger Keese. Have you ever met Roger Keese?
Yeah, I know Roger.
Oh, my God. Don't. Unless you really want to talk some serious Civil Warness, because he knows, again, that stuff came right through Chattanooga and famous battles all over the place. And he's the guy who owns the comedy club here.
Oh, Alfano?
Alfano had a house up there on Missionary Ridge, which was one of the highest points in Chattanooga, which where the rich people live because they can get out of the mosquitoes in the heat in the summer, right? Well, that all those houses, he was living in a antebellum house, and Roger went up there with a metal detector and found all kinds of musket balls and horse bits, and he knows that stuff backwards and forwards. He's really into it. One time I was, you know, at the club before the show, said somehow the Civil War came up, and he goes, "So you know anything about the Civil War?" A little, you know, my family was through here. I hear stuff. I've read a little. And he starts talking. My jaw was on the ground. How do you know all this, dude? And not some college professor. This is like college professor level.
Yeah. Stuff. People get fascinated with the Civil War. They deep dive on that stuff.
And I'm sure that traveling around the South doing, especially if you're doing one-nighters, now you're hitting those little towns way back up in there. I bet he's been to every battle park, every
stand-up be great for that kind of that stuff. Like I used to, when I would do cities, I would just go to the thrift stores and just rescue a lot of the books. Uh-huh. They had books on there that, you know, I knew from, you know, university and stuff that hadn't been touched in 10 years. And I would just take like 30 of them up front and go, "Hey, I'll give you $10 for this." And they're like, "Sure." You know, so
yeah, you're walking out gold mine. I get books. My uncle, who was in Florida now, he's 95 in a rest home. So when he went there and had the downsides, he gives me all this family stuff, which I had heard some about, but you know, half the time I was a little kid and you really don't care about it then. But he gives me all these books and pictures and family pictures, and I've been going through them over time, and it's like, oh my God, you know, I have a diary from, I think it's my grandmother's grandfather or great-grandfather who was in Atlanta or just north of Atlanta. He was in Marietta during the time of the Civil War, and one of the few railroads came across the front of there, was within a quarter of a mile of his front door. And he wrote a diary of his time. He stayed, and the rest, he was a cotton broker, and he mostly lived in Savannah, selling cotton back and forth to Europe. That's kind of was his gig. Mm-hmm. But they had this house in Atlanta, and they would come to Atlanta in the summer because Savannah had mosquitoes, malaria, all that crap. They would come to Atlanta. It was a little bit better. So he stayed at that house, and they all ran to Savannah, you know, outrun the army. But he wrote a diary of that time, and it was a big house. And the train was right there, and there would be encampments of soldiers there, and the officers would come up to his house, and he would have dinner with these and names all the officers and where they were from, you know. And those soldiers were, most of them weren't career soldiers. It was like,
yeah, they'd just been grabbed for that battle.
Hey man, I'm a lawyer from Ohio. And so he gets all these guys, and they're all brainiacs. You know how brainiacs are, where they talk and tables. So here he is in the midst of this war, having some of these brilliant guys at his house, you know, come to his house and have dinner. And pretty interesting read. That diary now was donated before I was born to University of North Carolina, and they almost had to translate it because his handwriting is so bad.
Right.
But I have a copy of that I read. And another thing that's in all that stuff, again, he was a cotton broker, right? Buying and selling cotton. And there's a document in there from some lawyer from like the 1920s, where one of his heirs had gone to this lawyer, and they were petitioning Congress to get paid for some amount of cotton that was stolen off the docks in Savannah at the time of the war. So it really, you know, you think of the Civil War happened way before we were there, but that kind of puts a face on it. This guy's talking about.
It gives you, it rolls it right up to, you know, through your family and right up, you know, to your front door. And you're like, oh yeah, we were involved in this, you know?
Yeah. Like This guy was old when this happened, 70s probably, and he talks about having to, you know, they stole all the livestock. We have one old horse that we hide in the woods, and it's not much good to anybody. If they steal it, they're going to eat it. And he's going out with his, he goes, I have to hide my shotgun because they take every firearm because I know you're going to shoot at them. But I got a shotgun. I'm going out trying to get shoot some stuff for me and the neighbors. You know, there's widows and with kids who can't take care of themselves at all. Yeah.
We were talking before we started about the, you know, freeze here in Texas 2 weeks ago and just how it shut down all modern life. And you bridge from here all the way back to there and like that, like having to hunt what's right around your house and, you know, that kind of stuff. And my family grew up on tobacco farms. Like I was the first generation that wasn't born on tobacco farms. And you look at that kind of history of Kentucky and sort of what it was to be, you know, first a migrant picker and then to actually own the land and have, you know, what tobacco did basically as it came through that culture. And it gave them enough money to start buying machinery. And then the machinery was enough to go, maybe we should move to the city. You know, and every time that stuff comes along, it moves you farther along and suddenly you're a stand-up comedian.
There you go. You get to where you can make enough money to pay for stuff that you don't have to be involved in the whole process. But then again, like out here, my yard, these neighbors are pretty spread out. My yard's about an acre and a half, but right behind my back fence is about 200 acres of woods. So, you know, it's one of those things, well, if it didn't get that bad, I got a shotgun, there's the woods. I'm better off than most people, you know, than you know, again, you live in the 12th floor of a high-rise apartment and there's no food, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I might have to go eat squirrels and rabbit and whatever's back there, but that's better than eating my shoe.
probably an expensive shoe though. You know, it probably tastes a little better because it costs $800.
Your Air Jordan or your whatever.
So tell me about your background in stand-up, man. How did, like, just run that for me real quick. How'd you get into all this?
Well, when I grew up in the panhandle of Texas, up near Pampa, Texas, up near Amarillo, you know where that is. Wait, it's an oil field town. It was about 30,000 then. I think it's down to about 12 now because you know how the oil patch works. But that's where I was from. Even if I did live someplace big, it was really before comedy clubs started. So you probably similar. I would see on TV, you know, my parents would watch Ed Sullivan and you would see someone every once in a while, or they watch Red Skelton all the damn time.
Yeah, sure.
And then you roll around to like the seventh or eighth grade and one of your friend's big brother had a prior eight-track or a prior or a Carlin thing, you know, and you'd sneak over to their house when their parents weren't home and you'd listen to Carlin and prior.
Exactly what I did in a basement with Ricky Shellman.
This is magic, you know, this is magic. I love this. And then over time, you know, you realize you have some humor that, you know, you make your friends laugh and you like that feeling you get from that. And you sort of, that may be, you know, you tend to move towards what you're good at. Athletes move towards sports, right? Because they're good at it. Smart guys move towards academics because that's what they're good at. And I was good at none of those things. You know, about the only thing I was really ever good at was saying smart ass shit and making people laugh. And that determines your place in the order. So I loved all that stuff. And then they finally got a comedy club in Amarillo that I saw a couple of shows, but I never tried any open mic. But I went to college at Texas Tech, and when I graduated, I'd worked off and on this ranch up in the Panhandle, and the guy I had been working for, he was in the oil business and the cattle business, and he'd gotten some income tax thing and had to go to a federal prison for a year over his business. So about the time I got out of college, he was like, man, can you come run this place? Because you're the only person that knows what's going on out here. You know, his brothers were scattered to the winds. And can you come run this? So I went back there and ran that business for a while he was in there. And after that ran its course, his family was all squabbly and was like, I got to get out of here. This is a good place for me to get off. So I moved to Arlington, Texas, with a plan. I thought I was going to go to grad school and something, but I just moved, and then I couldn't get enrolled in time, so I was just living down there. And I lived about a mile from the Funny Bone in Arlington, and I went to some shows. And, you know, Funny Bone was using pretty top-notch guys. You know?
It was a great chain.
Then, and just seeing that, and one night they're like, but that ticket was probably a $12 or $14 ticket. And then one night they go, hey, you can come to, this is back when you could charge for open mic. People were still coming to open mic.
Yeah.
You could come to open mic for $3 on Tuesday, and it was almost a packed show.
Yep.
So I went to open mic, and there was some good, the first open mic I ever saw, Ron White was there, new comic, you know, probably was about to start on the road. Bill Engvall was there.
Wow.
He was already a working guy, but this is back when working comics would come to open mic.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think they do that much anymore, but you kind of went back and did open mic and supported the thing. And
so what year was this? What year would this have been?
I started on the road, I think, in 88. So this was probably 1986, maybe. So Engvall was there, Ron White was there, some other mid-level guys, and then your local kind of open micers. And I watched it, and Ron was solid, and Bill obviously was closed the show and blew the doors off. But most of the kind of local ones, you know, were what they were. And
I'm right.
Like, I can do that.
I can do that. Those four words. I talked
to the manager.
Launched many a comedy career.
Who was Alex Raimondo at the time. And I said, hey, I want to give this a try. And he's like, write up 5 minutes of your own stuff. And we do tryouts like once a month. You'll come in at noon and do your 5 minutes. And if it's any good, we'll put you up. So I go in at noon. It's like him, the bartender, you know, some guy delivering liquor. There's like three guys watching you. And there you are on a stage with three guys, and you do your 5 minutes, and those guys don't really laugh at anything. You know,
yeah, what a horrible way to start a career.
So I did my five, and they're like, yeah, that's all right. You know, come on back. So I go back on open mic night, and I don't know any of those guys. I'm not from there. Don't know anybody. And go up and do my 5 minutes of mostly dick jokes. I still remember my first joke. If you
yeah, what is it?
The first joke I ever did was, I don't have stage fright. I have what's called microphone fright. Anything, something about 8 inches long and slender with a bulbous head on it gets anywhere close to my mouth, it makes me kind of nervous. That was it.
There you go. You know,
which was enough to get the ball rolling. You sure. know? It was better than half of what they'd seen so far. So that got a few laughs, and I kind of clumped through the rest of the five. After the show, I'm out there drinking a beer. And Ron and I had talked about being from Pampa, Texas. And Ron White came over there, and he goes, are you really from Pampa, Texas? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, I'm from Fritch, Texas, which is about 30 miles apart and is even a teenier dot. Fritch, Texas, at the time, maybe had 600 people lived there, maybe.
Good Lord.
I mean, it was
tiny. One of them was Ron White.
And Ron had lived there when he was like very young and then kind of grew up in Houston. But I'm like, yeah, man. And we ended up talking and drinking till they threw us out. And he lived close by. So when he was in town, you know, he'd come to the club and we'd party and hang out. And then when I started working on the road, we got booked together a lot and just became you know, friends, road guy, you know, like you and me, you probably know each other and everybody else. Friggin' 20 something years later, boom, he hooks up with the blue collar thing and goes through the roof. And he had told me a story about, that's how he met Foxworthy at one of his first open mics. And they just hit it off and played golf and, you know, stuff those guys do. And, you know, years later, Foxworthy was huge. And Ron said, I just called him one side and said, come on, dude, throw me a bone. Just let me open one show to say I did it one time. And I pretty much did that to Ron. I remember I sent him probably an email. Hey, man, remember when Foxworthy threw you a bone? Throw me a freaking bone. Just let me open one of those big shows in my life. Like I say, I did it. He's like, all right, meet me here. Gave me some, he says, it's going to be in Peoria, Illinois. Go to Peoria on this date. When you get there, you call me. All right, here's your hotel arrangements, you know, all that stuff. So I get there. I'm pretty sure it was what it turned out to be. He goes, come, my bus here, come to this place, and gave me the, it was the University of Illinois Champaign Basketball Arena.
Good guy.
Come to the University of Illinois Champaign Basketball Arena. Look around for my bus. So I get there, and here's his tour bus way parked way in the back of way out from the arena. Go there, knock on, hey, man, come on in. Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is so-and-so. Drink, all that stuff. Let's go to the show. Well, right next to where he was parked was some stairs that went down into the ground, you know, of the parking lot. It's like a town down there. I mean, there's halls down there, 20 feet wide. There's a golf cart there. They pick us up. You know, we go under the arena and shit. Walk out behind the stage, and you hear all that. There was 8,000 people there. You know,
Lord.
Which is a lot of people for a club guy, you know, club comic who's going, yeah, I did a show. There's 400 people there, God damn it. I'm on shit. 8,000, which luckily I remembered. I don't know if you remember this. It's kind of a famous interview. I don't know if it was, I think it may have been with Leno by that time, but it was on The Tonight Show, Jerry Seinfeld. And Leno was asking him, you remember those big shows, what that was like, you know, when you moved from the intimate club thing to that big deal? And Seinfeld was going, yeah, man, you know, it took me a while to learn that when you tell a joke in that kind of venue with that many people, the joke starts in the front row and it goes all the way to the top and then it comes back down. And you gotta wait. Because if you don't, you're going to start your joke before that's done, and they're not going to hear the beginning of the next joke. So you have to slow. You know, in a club, you're just
right.
constantly coming because you're trying to run over the drunks and everybody who's going to talk and shit. It's the exact opposite. He's like, it's going to go up, and then it's going to come back down, and you have to wait, or else you're going to fuck it up.
Right.
You know, and I had seen that at some point and just went, I guess that makes sense. And I'm standing right there, right before I'm going on. And Ron said something like, he goes, forgot to tell you, you kind of have to wait. Well, by then, you know, the lights are down and I'm almost walking out. I'm like, okay, thanks, man. And you get out there and you're about to shit your pants because there's literally faces, and I mean little bitty faces at that point, they're so far away. As far as you can see, I mean, it's just massive. And I did the first bit, you know, and you could just feel it going up like that till it hit the top. And I'm like, Seinfeld's awake. Seinfeld, because you're ready to.
Yeah.
And I wanna. He said, wait. Came back down. Oh my God. It's just like he said. And then I was good. After the first one, I got the timing. I got the timing of this motherfucker. I got it. So, does that answer the question? That was kind of a lengthy.
Yeah, answer. No, that's great. I love, you know, that kind of road life stories and, you know, stand up experiences.
And then, yeah. After and I figured that was going to be a one time thing because I'm just like, hey man, just throw me a bone because everybody wants that gig. It's sure. Not like they need you. everybody wants that gig. And so we do the show and we party and all that, you know, just like the stuff you do with Ron White. It wasn't any different. It was just bigger.
Right.
Party it up, all that shit. And he stayed on his tour bus and I was at the hotel. And the next day I was going, you know, he was going to keep going and I was going to go home, but I called him to say thanks for the gig and stuff. And, hey man, thanks. That was awesome. I really, that was sure appreciated. He's like, what are you doing next week? Nothing I can't get out of. You come meet me at my house in Atlanta. You come to my house on Friday morning and we'll go for the weekend. And it turned into about a 2-year deal where.
Oh, great. Yeah.
I was opening shows, not every, probably twice a month. I was probably going with him twice a month. And then, and worked for him as a writer too. There was sometimes he would, you know, he'd call me and be like, hey, Henley's opening the shows, but won't you come in the, write some material and sit on the side and watch this, watch these bits I'm doing, see if you can come up with some tags. So I would go and write, either open the shows or write, or, you know, it's, I don't know how other acts like that, but you know how Ron is. Well, one time we went to, I think it was Minnesota. He was doing these Indian casinos around. Same kind of deal. I flew up there. He had a jet. I went to Atlanta. Flew up there with him on the jet. And then they were going to, his tour bus was there. And he was going to get on the bus after that show and go west somewhere. And they were just going to drop me off at the airport in Minneapolis and I was going to fly back. So I had, you know, luggage for like 2 days.
Right.
And so we do the 2 nights and it's fun and, you know, we're partying. And the next show he was going to do was like in Rapid City, South Dakota, or someplace way out there. And it was going to be like on the following Thursday. And this was like a, we did Friday and Saturday at that Indian casino. So he had like 4 days to kill. And hey, he's like, hey, man, anytime he says, hey, man, you know, you're in trouble. Something's up.
He's had an idea for something.
Hey man, what are you doing this week? I don't know, you know. I'm gonna be on this bus by myself for like 5 days. Why don't you just come with me? When we get out to Rapid City, Henley's gonna be Hawksley or
Hawkins. Yeah, he wrote for him. Yeah, Hawkins wrote for him for a while, right?
Hawkins will be out there. You know these guys. Just come on, let's. I don't want to be on this bus for 4 days by myself. I don't have any clothes. He takes me to the mall. And by, what do you want? Just pick out a bunch of clothes. And he buys all these clothes and shit. And then we're on the bus and, you know, he wants to play golf every day and all that kind of stuff. So did that for, that ended up turning into like 2 weeks. You know, get out there. I'll buy your ticket back from Colorado Springs or something. Same thing. We're out there with Hawkins and I think it was Henley. I don't remember for sure. It was a long time ago, but same thing. Do that. Party every night to the point of exhaustion. No one has the kind of resilience Ron White that, I mean, you just cannot. Don't try and keep up with that guy.
No, it's otherworldly. I don't get how you live like that.
So we go out there. So I've been partying with him 4 days, just me and him, you know, so you can't even, there's no distractions. It's just you and him. And it's like, here, man, I don't really smoke pot, but when you're with him, you don't have any choice.
Uh-huh.
Like, I ain't smoke. It's not fun to be high by yourself. Come on, come on, come on, come on. So after a week of that stuff, I mean, you're exhausted, you're partied out, you're tired of it, you know. You've been around each other freaking 24 hours a day. You're kind of done. All right, you know, are you buying my ticket from Colorado Springs to home or what's the deal? Man, it takes like 2 whole days to get back home from Colorado Springs. Just come with me on the bus. And, you know, I don't want to spend 2 days on the bus by my, oh my God. No, I don't want to do that. Well, I'm not buying a ticket. You can either you can walk or you can come on the bus. I, so then by the time we pulled up in the driveway in front of his house, in a tour bus in front of this house, we got off the bus and weren't even speaking to each other at that point. You know, just get off the bus. See ya. You gonna mail me a check or what? Yeah, I'll get it to you. Walk off. I'll never see that guy again, you know, like 3 days later. Hey, man. What are you doing? So that went for about 2 years before it kind of ran its course. And that's sort of when I don't do that much stand-up anymore, because at that point, you know, I'd done clubs and all that stuff, and then I'd worked cruise ships for a few years, but I really did not like the whole – some guys, I guess, love that. But, you know, when I was doing cruise ships, you'd fly to a ship down there in the Caribbean someplace. You'd be on the ship 2 days probably, and then either move to another ship or go home or – so you're spending a ton of time in airports and customs and immigration and all that stuff. And then, you know, I was new. A lot of those guys go do the same ship every week. That's their.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine. Everybody right talks now, about that. It's its own little form of hell, getting trapped on those boats.
It's so they know people, but still it's almost like high school. You know, it's kind of like it's a relatively small group of people from all over the world, which that part's cool. You know, you get to meet a lot of cool people, but the ship, I thought the ships were really confining. You know, you're stuck out in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, I think a lot of people get that kind of claustrophobia. Was John O'Connell and some of those Austin guys working with White when you were with him?
Yeah, there was about a year there that he had a writing team assembled, and it was Rich Scheidner was kind of the head guy. Scheidner was there, John O'Connell, Tom Hester.
Wasn't Nancy with him for a while?
Nancy was there, Joey. I can't think of Joey's last name. It was Nancy Reed, Joey.
What was Joey's last name?
And we, you know, like once a year, Ron would rent this huge lake house down there in Austin. That was kind of this, it was a huge house, but it was sort of like a yoga school type thing sometimes. So the rooms, like the bedrooms, there was no doors on anything. And it was kind of this crazy house. And he would hire a cook to come there. And we would write jokes. Or I say early in the day, none of those guys got up till 11 in the morning. You know, you're lucky to see them. We would write jokes for a few hours and then kind of party. And then we would go to this bar called Pootie's Hilltop, I think was the name of it.
Yeah, I know that bar.
Pootie was Willie's tour manager. And we would go to Pootie's, and he would have, you know, like a written on big pieces of paper on the floor, these jokes, and he would do a bunch of the new jokes and then close with about 10 of polished off stuff and working on new material. So we would do that about once a year. And then 1 year we did a bunch of theaters. You know, he had two buses. He had his bus, and then he rented Martina McBride's crew bus. I guess it was a time of year where she wasn't touring much. So we were on her crew bus, had two buses. And we did like Amarillo, Lubbock, Wichita Falls, you know, these kind of mid-sized towns in Texas, going around doing these theaters that probably held, you know, like 2,000 or something, doing shows. So like the first night, and we do the show, go to some bars, party till the bars close. Then we get back on the buses and leave right then to drive to the next gig. And then when you got there, I mean, the crew bus all had bunks. So we were pretty much just living on the bus. And Ron's bus is decked out. You know, it's that his tour bus. I think he told me it cost almost $1 million one time for his tour bus.
Yeah, Dan Whitney was here at the Irwin Center here in Austin. And Tom Ryan happened to be in town doing a gig, and we went down and saw Whitney. He had two tour buses, and I was like, what's the second tour bus for, Dan? Your shirt sleeves?
Well, the first night, I think, was Amarillo. I can't remember for sure. One of those places up there. But we party, you know. All right, everybody get on the bus, and we're going to go. All you motherfuckers go get on your bus, and I'm going to get on my bus because you're the crew, and that's the crew bus. So we leave. Well, we're still up partying, you know. We're not going to go to sleep just because the bar shut down. We had party materials on the bus, and we're, you know, and again, those people that you were with, O'Connell, Hester, Joey, Nancy, all world-class partiers, you know. So we're up, and all, you know, we're going down the highway for about an hour, and then you feel the bus pulling over to the side of the road. Like, oh shit, what's, you know, it's 3 a.m. or something. Something's happened. What's up? The door opens. Ron gets on. Like, what's the matter? And he's like, I'm lonely over there by myself on my bus. I knew you guys were still up. It's lonely over there. But
lonely at the top, man.
So
fun down with the people down below deck.
So we partied on.
Now, Ron paid me $1,500 at some point and doesn't know it. His manager, John McDonald, I think, was his manager.
Right.
He hired me to do some writing for Ron, or test writing. And I wrote some stuff, and he's like, Ron liked it. He goes, but he's not doing material. Like you have to record it and test it out and all that. And I'm like, well, I don't really go out and do much stand-up anymore. So he paid me, but never used the material. So who knows?
Yeah, he doesn't like to read stuff, you know, because I had people go, I wrote some stuff I think he'd like. And I'm like, you're going to have to record it, and I could probably get it to Kathy or something. But he's not, A, he just doesn't like to read that kind of stuff. But B, he wants to see if it works, you know.
That makes perfect sense.
That much money. He wants to see if it, hang on 1 second. I got my Red Ryder out.
You being attacked by an armadillo?
Right there, man. You hear that? Right there is the sound of freedom, God damn it.
What was it?
A beer can.
I'll give you your BB gun. I've been shot by BB guns. I survived that.
The sound of freedom. This is an old Red Ryder, too.
That's a dead, beer can right there.
Yeah, I drank some Shiners last night.
Well, if we ever get attacked by beer, I'm coming to you for protection.
All right, I got it.
I told a guy once down here, you know, Texas, like, even though it's Austin, it's still super conservative. I was talking to a guy who was super conservative. I'm like, how about this? How about you have to give up all your guns, but we'll melt them down and build a wall out of it? You know, let's compromise a little bit.
That would perplex someone.
Yeah, he didn't get the humor.
How bad do I want to do that?
He's like, yeah, but that would upset some of my friends. I'm like, it's a joke, man.
But the question you asked me, so I did cruise ships, but I didn't like them. But it was steady work, and the money was, at the time, was okay. I think they're making better money now. And then I worked with Ron, and that ran its course. So there I was at that point. It's like, I was in my mid-50s, I guess, probably. It's like, do I want to go back to doing those dumpy clubs on the road and staying in those shitty condos? And
it's, yeah.
And begging for gigs at places I don't want to be. And I didn't, you know. And by then, I was working at this hang gliding place.
Yeah, tell me about that. How'd you get into all that? Sort of, that's a whole another wing of the Kid Dave legacy right there, jumping off Lookout Mountain.
And then it was like, I think I'll just do the hang gliding. I get to sleep in my own bed every night. But so how I started with that, I was living in Atlanta. I was married. And I was working the Chattanooga Club, and I'd seen it in a magazine one time. So when I came to the club, you know, I called this place, and and came out and did a morning lesson where they've got some small hills where you start practicing to run off of there. And I did the morning lesson and I dug it. And it's 2 hours away, so I came back and learned how to fly hang gliders and tried to fly when I could, but I wasn't around very much. But my dad, again, this turns into a longer story. My dad had an airplane.
You're from the South. You get legacy, you know, to be able to tell long stories. That's a Southern thing.
There's no short stories in the South. So my dad had a Cessna 172 airplane. And I had taken some flying lessons when I was young, but, you know, I was in college. I just didn't have time or money. So I didn't really pursue it. But he had a plane, and my dad called me and said, look, he had retired by then from the old business. And he says, I want to fly to Alaska and back. But he was having some health issues, and his flying medical was kind of sketchy. He goes, okay, I don't want to go by myself. My medical is on the rocks. If you go finish your pilot's license, I'll pay for that, and I'll pay for the whole trip to Alaska. So I live like two blocks from an airport in Atlanta, so I'd ride my bike over there and go take flying lessons. Got my license, got my truck, drove to Amarillo, Texas. 3 days after I got my pilot's license, we left to fly to the North Slope of Alaska. My first cross country in an airplane after I got my pilot's license was to
into the heart of the ice beast.
A place called Coldfoot, Alaska, which is about 200 miles from the Bering Sea. And so we did that, flew up there and back, and I got back here. Well, about that time, I was in the process of getting a divorce. And I hated Atlanta. I never liked Atlanta.
That's where I knew you from, was the Punchline in Atlanta. I think it's where we first met. I always thought you were from Atlanta.
I think the very first time we met was at Charlie Goodnight's one time.
That might have been. I met a lot of people at Charlie Goodnight's.
I think it was at Goodnight's. I think, again, I haven't done Goodnight's in many years, but I think Goodnight's was one of those shows where, you know, they had open mic night, and then the feature for the week went up and closed like 20 minutes or something. Yeah. So I was there to close that show, and the open mic crew came through, and I think you were just up there to do a set or something. And we met, and I think you told me you knew Lawrence somehow, but I think the first time we met was at Goodnight's.
Yeah, it probably was. I lived there for 4 years, so I was that house kind of headliner, MC whenever they needed something. So I hung out there a lot. I loved that club.
Yeah, that was a good one. So I left Atlanta, and I'm like, I worked on the road all the time. You know, you could live anywhere, really. I'm like, I'll just move up to the hang glider park, rent a cabin. That'll work. And I thought I was going to move back to Texas, really, but I didn't have time to do that. It's like, I got to keep going. So I moved up here, and the way we have teach the foot launch where you run off the mountain with your glider, we teach that, but we also have a big program where we take a beefed up glider, put an instructor in there, and then we take a passenger who doesn't know anything, just hook them in, and we tow them up behind an ultralight airplane and release them, and then they fly down with the instructor. And so I moved up here, and my friend who was running the place at the time knew I just got back from this airplane trip. He goes, you got a pilot's license? Yeah. You want to learn how to fly these and be a backup tow pilot? Sure. It's a little open cockpit, stick and rudder plane. They're cool. Yeah, man, that looks like fun. So I trained up in that plane. And about 2 weeks later, the main tow pilot guy quit to go take a job flying tourists around in Costa Rica. And they're like, wow, we don't have a tow plane. You want to be the tow plane guy for the summer? We need somebody. And I was working for Carnival at the time. So I'm like, let me call those guys. And I called Carnival. And again, I wasn't one of their regular dudes. I'd call once a month. Hey, you got any spots? Yeah, you know, Ronnie Bullard's got to go to his kid's graduation. Here's a spot. You know, some other guy's got a wedding to whatever.
Right.
Here's a place. Here's a place. Here's a place. And I would get some gigs like that. And I called those guys. I'm like, I got this other offer for the summer. Is this going to be a problem? And they're like, no, call us in the spring. I mean, in the fall, when you guys are done, call us and we'll start hooking you up again. And this turned into enough of the year. This is probably an 8 month out of the year gig. And then, like, I didn't want to do cruise ships anymore, you know? Yeah. And then I could pick a couple of months of my favorite road clubs to go do. And I would do that. So I kind of started backing out of comedy at that point again. And then I started working for Ron. And then after that ran its course, there's a few clubs I would go do, but I have dogs and I live by myself and it's hard to get someone to watch the dogs in the winter. So I don't hardly, I'll go out and there's some Midwest clubs that I like and they're close to my family and stuff. I'll go do those every once in a while, but I only do a couple of weeks of stand-up a year anymore. I love doing it.
It just becomes one of those things, man, where it's like you're saying, it's more trouble in some ways than it's worth. Once I started writing in LA, I didn't do stand up for 7 years. I sold my old act, you know, to somebody and I got back into it after I left LA, but never more than 3 or 4 weeks a year.
Yeah, I think that's how I got out of it. But I think a lot of people kind of age out of it. You know, I can still go into Chattanooga and I do fine. You know, my act isn't really age centric or so much pop culture touchstones that I need to know all this stuff that people like Instagram, Twitter, Netflix. I don't have any of that stuff. I don't tell any jokes about that, but you can still tell stories about your family or that stuff is universal and timeless. You know, everybody's gonna have the weird cousin or the goofy teacher or whatever. Those stories transcend age and generations. So I still do fine over there. But I know a lot of guys, you know, entertainment in general tends to be oriented towards the young and draws young performers and guys kind of age. That's where a lot of those cruise ship guys go.
Yeah. I mean,
it's like they can't get club gigs anymore, which for them, I would think if my choice was cruise ships or dumpy clubs on the road, I would probably go do the cruise ships too, because I drive to the airport. They fly me someplace. They feed me. I eat good food. I only do a couple of shows. The crowds are most of the cruise ships I did. I didn't. Have you ever done any ships, cruise ships?
No, I was booked a couple of times when I was living in Florida when I was in school down there, and I had to cancel them because of different things. And over the years, you know, because you know Kostaki Economopoulos, you know, yeah. Kostaki from Atlanta.
I can stop you for 1 second, since you asked me.
Yeah.
About Kostaki. And Kostaki tells me this story because I don't really remember, you know, how, when you're the comic and working, you meet a zillion people and you can't remember names or anything else. I'd done a show at a comic cafe. Did you ever do a comic? It was Chris DePetta's club in Marietta years ago. So had done the show at a comic cafe, drink at the bar after the whole nine yards. And I'm leaving the club. And this is the story that he tells to me, because again, this is an everyday thing and I don't remember. But he goes, years later, after he was up and established and going and way funnier than me, he goes, hey, man.
Always starts with, hey, man.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember this or not, but when I was young, I think he was in high school or just out of high school or something. He goes, I loved comedy. I loved everything about it. I wanted to be a comedian. And I went to a comic cafe and you're one of the comics. And I hung around after the show and you were leaving. And I stopped you in the parking lot. Said, hey, man, can I talk to you a minute about comedy? And you're like, sure. And you talked to me out there for like about a half an hour about comedy, how to get into comedy, how comedy goes. He goes, after I got done talking to you, he goes, that right then at that second, that's when I decided I'm doing it. This is what I'm gonna fucking do. And you were the guy, man. You were the that tipped the teeter-totter over to I'm going. And it was like, yay me, you know. He turned out to be, you know, I mean, I don't have to describe him to you. He's, when you watch him, you're just like, Jesus Christ, this guy is really good.
Yeah, Kostaki's so much fun. Such an affable human being, you know, one of the nicest guys I know.
Well, and his writing is solid, you know, and, yeah, and very kind of an individual. That's what you always hear people talking about, people stealing jokes, whatever. And some people, you can't steal their jokes because they just don't work for anybody but him. And he's kind of, I think, kind of one of those guys, especially like, well, I went up and spent half an hour talking about being drunk, you know. This guy's talking about all this stuff and shit he wrote 2 days ago, and I'm doing stuff that at least 5 years old or more.
Yeah, so him and Tom Simmons were always, I always think of those guys together, both such good technicians, such good writers, and great on stage. But you did it. You got him started, man. You could have stopped him right there and said, dude, go be a lawyer or something. He was in political science.
So you're not a chick. Fuck you. I'm not talking to you. And you know what? And there's plenty of comics that probably would have done that. Just blown it off. I don't have time to talk this shit with you. But the whole, like, I'm in a Facebook group that is oriented, is written by a long time, probably 30 years in the business, and pretty Dobie Maxwell, if you're familiar with him.
I don't know him, but I know who he is.
I've never met him in person, but I've, you know how you kind of move in the same groups and you know of him. And he has this thing, and it's kind of oriented towards new acts who have questions and stuff. And I stumbled in there somehow and started commenting on a few things, and the comments started to get longer. And he sent me a text one time, and he's like, man, this is what I really wanted this to turn into. Guys who know this stuff besides himself. He goes, I don't want to be the only voice. People who are, and there's other pretty well-known, fairly well-established comics in there, that can tell answer these questions, you know, and provide their own stuff on how to write jokes or how the road works or whatever. And I really appreciate it. I'm like, man, I think the best that, you know, they teach comedy workshops all over the country, but I think the best comedy workshops are in green rooms of comedy clubs and in condos of comedy clubs, where, again, you sit in those clubs, and some of these guys, you know, I worked with Foxworthy in comedy clubs. I stayed in condos with Ron White and Ingvall and Rob Schneider and guys that went up to that level that tell you things. They go, hey, man, I watched your show, and can I give you a piece of advice? And they don't have to do that.
Sure.
They can just go, I don't even walk in the show until you're done. I don't give a fuck what you're doing. But they don't. They watch your show. Hey, man, I wrote a tag for you. Or what if you did this instead of that? And these guys turn out to be massive comics that you could never pay them back for that gems of information they gave you. The only thing you can do is try and pass it on to the next guy. And that's what I said to him. He's like, thanks for being in here. Like, I owe people, yeah, man. Yeah. I owe a lot of people that I can't pay. How am I going to pay Foxworthy back? How am I going to pay Ron White back? You know, there's no way, but I can pass it on to the next guys who, that gets me off the hook with karma as far as my debt, I think, to people that helped me.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's the good part of the stand-up community. I miss that stuff. It's especially like the green rooms. And like I said, I was a house guy at Goodnights forever, and guys would come through and I'd just met everybody. I'd just hang out with them. And yeah, it was a great environment. Well, this was fun, man. We're up over an hour. I'm going to let you go hunt some more beer cans. I'm sure they're probably collecting around your house.
I don't have any beer out here. I got a little bit of moonshine left. So I'm having a little of that.
Well, you're the only person that's drunk moonshine on their back porch so far on the podcast. So I think this is one of my favorite episodes. You know, how can you beat that?
I'm almost out. This is great moonshine. I'm almost out.
Where do you get moonshine?
I live in Northwest Georgia.
I know. I'm like, do you have a source? Are you making it yourself?
I don't make it. The guy that this is the thing about moonshine. There's a lot of it around, but the quality does vary. And this guy that I used to work with, who was one of my pilots at the hang glider park, who was a very funny character in his own right. He'd been an Army Ranger, and he's like a survivalist guy now. He's walking his house and guns everywhere, gun safes, all that stuff. But he was living on this guy who had this huge house here, and that guy traveled a lot for business, and he had a wife and a young son there, and he had made this guy deal. He goes, I got a place cleared out for a trailer up there, and I'm gone a lot. I'm worried about my wife and my son. If you'll just come live up here, I'll let you stay here for free just to kind of be security out, because it was way out there in the country. And so he was living out there and working for me some. And I went up there once, and there was a jug like this sitting outside the trailer, you know, under the trailer, but outside. I'm like, what's that? That's some moonshine. Well, let's drink it. That's not very good. Where'd you get it? And he goes, there were some guys came up here that were cutting trees for a power line company or something. And I got to talking to them, and we were talking about guns and stuff. And one of them's like, hey, you want some moonshine? Yeah, here. And gave him the jug. And he goes, I tasted it. It's pretty bad. And like, well, we don't have anything else, so why not? Picked it up and tasted it. It was just like, looked at it, and you could see some kind of small critters in there swimming up. And how any animal
survives? How does that live? Yeah,
I don't know, but it was bad. But this moonshine here, I've never met the guy who makes it. It's my friend's uncle, who's probably in his 90s. This is like a family recipe that's 130 years old or something. And the uncle, like once a year, makes up a batch of moonshine. He makes corn, grape, and peach. And I can get a fair amount of the regular. I mean, the last time I bought some, I probably bought 8 jugs of this stuff. The corn you can get, the peach is hard to get because it's magic. And you almost got to fight for that. And the grape's really good too. But
yeah, I guess I didn't really realize there were designer flavors of moonshine out there, but I guess that makes sense. You know, you got to make it out of something, got to flavor it with something.
Yeah, the concept is pretty basic. And some, you know, like anything, some guys are artists and some guys are journeymen. And there you go.
Got to find yourself a moonshine artist. I think that's the lesson. Well, this was super fun, man. Like I said, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Good to see you.
Yeah, I'll swing back around some point. I'm trying to, you know, carve out some connection, some reconnection with people around the world. I realize I've got like 500 guys around this country that I like. I never get to see anymore, so might as well use Zoom to connect. You know, why not?
Well, my nephew's in Austin, and I want to get out there sometime this year, so maybe we can do lunch or whatever.
Yeah, sounds good. Let me know.
I'll chase you down.
For sure.
Thanks for having me.
All right, buddy. That's Kid Dave, everybody. Thanks again for coming into the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We will see you next time. Go out there and persuade somebody.